Hello, friends, and welcome to Impact Everywhere, the podcast that looks for people having a positive impact in unexpected places. Today, we have a really funny guest for you. His name is Jack Sim, and he's also known as Mr. Toilet, the world's number two man, because of the work that he's done in the sanitation space over the last two decades. Sanitation is still a really big problem and affects more than 2.5 billion people all across the world. Jack decided to start the World Toilet Organization back in 2001 because he thought it would be great to play a pun on the WTO, the World Trade Organization. Jack and I met a year ago because we were speaking on the same panel, and we've kept in touch ever since. And I've always been blown away by how humble and wise he is. At 63 years old, Jack is still a child, always coming up with crazy, whimsical ideas to have the largest impact possible. And I wanted to invite him onto this podcast because he is consistently the underdog in every campaign that he participates in, yet he's capable of attracting phenomenal amounts of attention using a combination of humor and guerrilla marketing. One of his greatest accomplishments was actually convincing the United Nations to create World Toilet Day. And I thought I'd start right here to give you guys a little bit of context. This is Jack Sim, and here he is talking about his greatest accomplishment to date.
Yeah, so it's really a dream. We don't ever know that it's going to happen or not. In the year 2001, when we started the World Toilet Organization, which was already very controversial because which organization would put the word toilet in the middle of their name and play a pun on the World Trade Organization using the acronym WTO? We did that during the first World Toilet Summit, attended by 15 countries' government. Can you imagine? It sounds like a joke, but it's actually very serious because every country suffers from either dirty public toilet or having no toilets or having pollution of the sewage directly discharged into the rivers and the lakes. That day was 19th of November, and on stage, we declared that day the World Toilet Day. Immediately, the media was very excited and we were instant rock star. And all over the world, they were publishing about this crazy World Toilet Organization, but legitimizing it for us as a very serious subject. So every year, people celebrated World Toilet Day and it became larger and larger. And our popularity then made us believe that the UN will adopt this. But in order to get the UN to adopt this, you must get a government to propose a UN resolution to the General Assembly, to 193 governments represented by their ambassadors. And all of them have to agree, or at least a majority have to agree, but no objection. So trying to convince the Singapore government that we should table a World Toilet Day, it took 13 years. When we went to ask other association members, to ask their government, the German government, the US government, the Indian government, no government would even want to listen to this. So Singapore is much easier because the country is very small. For a citizen to talk to a minister is faster. But most of the time they will say, we can't go to the UN and table this resolution because it's going to embarrass us. And one day when my foreign affairs minister lost the election, I took him to Hainan Island in China for the World Toilet Summit in 2011. And he was so impressed. And he said, how did you pull this through? This is 1,000 Chinese people, including the governor, the mayor, the party secretary, and it costs a lot to do this. I said, the reason you don't know is because the Singapore media doesn't write about my work overseas. But if you Google, you'll find a lot of it. So he says, never mind. How can I help you? I say, I would like you to make a phone call back to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Although you are no more the minister, you were the minister last month and they listened to you. So he made the arrangement and they gave me a hearing and then they realized that this is something worthy. And after that, we have to go to the UN General Assembly president, which is not Secretary General, another person who is like the Speaker of Parliament in the UN. And we have to convince him that he should table this subject, because if he don't think it's worthy of tabling, nobody even gets to hear it. So we convinced him during that time, and then we went to have lunch, dinner, reception, as many of the 193 ambassadors at the UN, and then they have to bring back the message to their government. So eventually we have it unanimously adopted. So that was a big milestone.
Wow. It's the whole like overnight success that took 15 years to build sort of story, where because you did so much work on the back end and proved the fact that this was something legitimate and was addressing a concern, and it had actually built up a lot of traction, that you were finally able to get a little bit of attention from the local government.
Yeah, because prophets are not welcome at home. I don't know in Canada, is it better? But in Singapore, they would prefer to listen to somebody from Canada than to somebody from Singapore.
You're absolutely right. Even in the earlier section of my career, when I was a photographer traveling the world, I just remember that when I traveled internationally in the outside world, I was received completely differently. It made me more prestigious and special for some reason, and the doors would just open. I think even today, I've actually done very few projects here in Canada because I guess I'm Canadian. It's just not exotic. You're someone who's a master storyteller and a master marketer, and you've been working on this problem for so many years now. When do you think enough awareness is enough?
Whenever problems exist, you have to be relentless until the problem disappears. And the way I look at the trends now for sanitation, the awareness is pretty high, especially during COVID. The hygiene awareness is actually at the highest. And the World Toilet Organization has been able to mobilize Prime Minister Modi to build 110 million toilets. We have built a momentum of a movement that a lot of people want toilet, and politicians are using toilets as an election ticket. And so from oblivion to become an election ticket, I think that's a big success. And even in countries where you don't have election, like China, President Xi Jinping is now the toilet champion of China Toilet Revolution. And it's single-handedly started by him. Now, if you go to China, tourist toilets used to be disgusting. And in the last 3 years, it's as clean as Japanese toilet. And so it's a real revolution. Then I go to America toilet, and then it's like the same 30 years ago. No change. So maybe after Donald Trump retire, he should be the toilet champion, because he's kind of very related to this subject, you know?
Oh my gosh. There, speaking of Donald Trump, there is a city that named, what was that in your documentary? A city that named itself after Donald Trump to raise awareness for the toilet?
Oh, our Indian member, Sulab International, thought that if he were to name a village called Trump Village, then he would be able to raise a lot of donations from Americans, because they love their president. And when their president name is in this village, everybody will get toilet. So he promised all the villagers that they will get toilet. Then he start fundraising, and no money. So he has to spend his own money to build toilets for everybody in Trump Village. It's out of his own pocket now.
Oh, wow. But the village is still called Trump Village, and everyone has toilets. So it still has a happy ending.
I think it was so controversial that somebody represent Donald Trump came to visit as well. But I think it was a marketing stunt, but it didn't raise any money. Yes.
So when it comes to marketing stunts, because you've done so many of these different things, if anything, you're probably one of the most creative people I know when it comes to thinking of unique and different ways to engage people. How do you know if you're going too far with a stunt in order to attract attention?
I think that storytelling has some ethos. And one of the things is not to be vulgar. And in some countries, the same word shit is not vulgar. In America, you say that he is the shit, it's actually a compliment, right? If you go to another country, like BBC, they don't allow me to say the word shit. And before every interview, if it's live, they say, please, please don't utter this word shit. So there are different culture, right? In the Middle East, you can never say shit. In fact, when you want to say toilet, you might better say hygiene or something like that, right? Language are different in different countries and it has different meaning. But the most important thing in communication is getting the message across successfully. We're just three people and myself, and we are able to create a worldwide revolution because our message is authentic and we add a blend of humor behind it. We break the ice on the subject and we never endorse products. We are not beholden to companies. We are not beholden to governments or anybody. We can say whatever shit we want to say, but we say it honestly.
I think it's really interesting that you use comedy to raise awareness for something that's really, really serious. And I'm curious how you manage to strike that right balance between making something funny and having people actually take it seriously. What kind of strategies do you use in order to do that? Because once you've gotten the initial attention through the marketing puns or something similar, you still need to find a way to back that up somehow. So, you know, how do you get people who are maybe uncomfortable about a subject to really sit down and have that important discussion?
So actually, people are constipated with toilets in their mind. They want to say about it, but they can't. So all we have to do is to give them permission to speak about the subject and to make it legit for them. And once they see that others are talking about it, then they can say it themselves. You see, we have been telling this story about toilet for 20 years and the subject is still fresh. So can you imagine telling the same story for 20 years and it's always new? It's just like people making love songs for 100 years and you still want to listen to the next love song. It's the authenticity, the freshness, the contextual situation that we are using it, and the personalization of the story. And if you tell it from your heart, it never goes wrong.
I guess you have the benefit of the fact that everyone goes to the bathroom every single day. So it does very much remain a top of mind subject. And it is quite easy for people to imagine how uncomfortable or inconvenient it might be. How do you get people to really shift from being receptive to a story into actually being able to take action, since you're not the one that is providing the solution, you're the one that is raising awareness?
So this is the leverage model that we employ. You cannot get to the first and second and third estate, right? The first estate is the clergy, the pope, the religious leader. The second estate is the sovereign, the president, minister, prime minister. The third estate is the courts. And the fourth estate is the media. And getting to the media is our door to influencing everybody else above. And once you are a good storyteller, the media legitimize the story. The politician take the story and turn it into an election agenda that gets them popularity and power. The bureaucrats start to write policy and allocate funds to the toilets, and then toilets gets built. The celebrities join in to improve their image and to reach out to a new group of people. The clergy then start to support it because their followers goes to the toilet. The professors, the academia, join in because they need publication or they will perish. Then the donors join in because there's a bigger bang for the buck now. The awareness is very clear. And the NGOs come and collect the money from the donor. And the social entrepreneur get the investment. And in the end, everybody gets toilet. But each of the stakeholder takes away something different, very personalized to their own aspiration.
I love that very nice model of mutual benefit or mutual exploitation, as I think you've called it before in one of your talks, where everyone basically gets to play their role and to make a difference themselves. Is your aspiration to basically make yourself obsolete, or are you going to transition into more of an executional model? Because, well, you're only three people. So like, what become the next steps as awareness grows to the stage where it hopefully is no longer necessary?
In a movement, you don't want to be the hero. You want to create millions of heroes. And then it becomes their job the moment they take ownership of the agenda in their own local area, in their own space. It's very important not to be the obstacle of your own mission. You create a movement and it has a life of its own. You cannot take credit for all the work that's done because it's done by so many people, but each of them are very, very happy to do it because it is aligned to their own aspiration. So as the movement continues to grow, all kinds of creativity and diversity of ideas start to manifest itself. And this is the beauty because from the very first day, I was not the leader, but the instigator, the facilitator, and it was everybody who did the job. I think that today's awareness has effectively already converted India toilet culture, especially driven by Prime Minister Modi, that everybody should have a toilet. Now, they have built 110 million toilets, which is the biggest toilet construction project in the history of mankind. The next step is that people should be using this toilet, cleaning it, maintaining it, and ensuring that the sewage don't go into the river waterways or even underground water that contaminates the well. So these are still a lot of work. And what we are doing is to get everybody to understand this and to watch it out themselves. All kind of big NGOs are also involved. The Red Cross and World Health Organization. Everyone propagates it and everyone celebrates World Toilet Day, 19th of November. So in fact, the work is now having a life of its own that I actually went on to do another big challenge called poverty. Sanitation affects about 2.5 billion people. 2.5 billion people still don't have proper sanitation, but 4 billion people are poor. So my life is going to end in about 16 and a half years. I'm now 63. I plan to die at 80. And so I have not much time. And so I found a bigger challenge than toilets. And now I created a second NGO called the BOP Hub, and I want to end global poverty. And again, it sounds ridiculous. Just as it sounds ridiculous when we started the World Toilet Organization, people would laugh at us. And we don't even have a single employee in this case. Everyone is a volunteer. So we started to promote this concept that poverty is actually a marketplace. We can convert all the people into entrepreneurs, micro entrepreneurs, and unlock their good work ethics and give them a higher value add to their produce. If you plant chili, you should make chili sauce. If you grow coffee, you should roast coffee, sell coffee powder. Don't just stay at primary produce. So a lot of traction. And just yesterday, the University of Singapore says we want to create a center of excellence for social system innovation, and we want to build it with you, and we will give you 5 employees and they will run your show for you. So I get 5 employees paid for free, and I think this is the leverage model. The whole world is ready to conspire with any person who really want to achieve something.
It's so phenomenal that you can actually just have an idea, believe in it, move forward, and find the right allies in order to bring something to life. So I'm curious, I think there are a lot of people out there in the world that want to do something, have ideas, but don't even know where to start. What are some of the best practices that you're currently having to apply as you're starting a brand new initiative? How do you take all these lessons that you've learned over the course of business, of building the World Toilet Organization, and now this newest initiative of the BOP Hub? You know, what are the recurring patterns of things that you recommend when people are tackling, especially big, large, complex problems, and they feel really small?
Yeah, there's always this tendency where you have this imposter syndrome and you think you shouldn't be the one to do it. You're not big enough. Nobody is big enough until they believe that it can be done. So when you go out there, The first thing to do is to find a very, very big problem. Could be for 1 million people, preferably more than a billion people. If you are able to find a problem that is very large, that itself is already a treasure that you have just found, because it's going to give you so much fulfillment when you are able to solve it. So I look for very, very big problems that are unsolved. In this case, poverty. And then why would it need to be solved anyway? Because if it's not solved, then you will have people dying of hunger. You'll have people living in very unfair, unjust situation, like drinking dirty water, having no housing, no safety from crimes, no electricity, no Wi-Fi, no cooking stove, and no education and no healthcare. So there's so many things that needs to be addressed. And the fastest way to address it is to incentivize other people to do it. In fact, you can achieve anything as long as you can get others to do it. And this is how we start to call out, and naturally the ones who attracted to it comes to us. So we do not go out to push agenda to people. We use a pull strategy and we say we want to solve this, and we invite people to walk with us to a beautiful future.
Basically, everything that you're saying all revolves around telling stories, setting a vision, and believing in how things are possible. But ultimately, you have a very limited amount of resources in order to get things done once you do accomplish, or once you do get the attention. So how do you then close the gap between the big promises that are being made and the problems that you're facing? Because I think in so many situations, and we see this a lot of time, is when the marketing gets ahead of the actual solution, we have a problem where people profess to be able to saving something or solving a big, really, really big issue, but not actually knowing how.
Internal resources are very, very limited, even if you are the biggest NGO in the world, even if you are the biggest company in the world, your resources are limited according to the size of your entity. But all external resources are unlimited. So when you say, how do you handle when you have limited resources? The truth is, I have unlimited resources. All I have to do not to employ too many people, so that the culture of my team is to leverage outside external resources. If I have a very big team, I will start to use internal resources, which is limited, which is also expensive, which will mean that I have to keep on fundraising, and which will make me very, very stressed and waste a lot of time. Sometimes I see NGO wasting 50% of their time in fundraising. In fact, they also have to fundraise for their fundraiser, because you have to pay these people to go on the phone calls. So I think it's better to be frugal and to leverage all the people outside. Now, why would people want to join a movement? As I explained earlier, they come for various reasons, from the kindness of their heart, from a political agenda, from a visibility angle, for getting power, getting readership, getting advertising income. Everybody takes away what they want. And we do not moralize a problem. We solve it, and you solve it through other people. In the American classic Tom Sawyer, there's a story that Tom Sawyer was punished by Auntie Polly to paint the fence on a Sunday morning. He hates to work, but what does he do? He pretends to enjoy painting the fence. And when his friends came and say, "Tom Sawyer, why are you working?" He says, "I'm not working. I'm having fun." And his friends say, "Can I try?" And he says, "No, unless you pay me, I'm not going to let you paint." Then they start to pay him. And of course, they are children. He gets paid with a rat on the string, a broken log, a coin, or whatever gems that they pick up, right? And the fact is that all his friends happily painted the fence 3 coats. The moral of this lesson is this: you can achieve anything as long as you can motivate others to do it. Second, you must pre-qualify them that they are really interested, not just coming for fun, but actually wanting to do the work. Thirdly, they should pay you to do the work for you. And fourthly, you should get rewarded by somebody else. That's the leverage model, and it works very well. Every year, we have a World Toilet Summit that is hosted by a city government, chief minister, tourism minister, prime minister, and they pays for it. They pay about $300,000 to get this rights to run this event, flying all the speakers around the world and paying for the hotels and the ballrooms and conference center. We get $50,000 from giving them the hosting rights. And so we get paid, they pay for the event, and everybody comes, and policies are made, legacies are left behind. Last year, the governor of Sao Paulo hosted World Toilet Summit, and a few months later, a law is passed in Brazil to allow private investment into government-owned water company to treat their sewage. And this law is phenomenal because 50% of all the sewage of Brazil are untreated and ended up in the river, in the sea, on the beaches, and in landfill. So can you imagine, they paid for it, we curate the conversation, they pass the law, environmentally things are safe, and also people become healthy, and we get paid. So why did they want to host our event? Because if you pay $350,000, you get more than $100 million of media coverage. On top of that, you get a legacy of change, because in most countries, they never had a meeting about toilet across party line, across ministry, across sectors. Private companies and public figures and celebrities, movie stars, everybody come together. So it's really, really cost efficient, effective, and very cheap to change whatever is the status quo for the better.
I really love that Tom Sawyer story and this idea of leverage. You know, hearing you talk and the scale at which you are working makes me wonder what I've been missing out on, because when I, you know, go down to the micro level, the way that I bring my projects to life, I've kind of been saying the same thing, which is the way you get lots of volunteers to come on board to be a part of the project is to make sure that you're offering them the opportunity to participate in something that they want to be a part of. Right? Like, people pay money to do the things that they want to do. And if you can offer them an opportunity to be part of something greater, to put their time to use, to offer them a unique experience, then you can do all of that without money in the intermediary. And you've just like taken that same idea and like supersized it to like government level, which I think is like really, really inspiring. And so some food for thought there, definitely to think about. But I love how you can take something and be a really small, but a really, really effective team. As you've taken this different model and you've brought it to different countries, what are some unexpected challenges that you've encountered as you've tried to bring forward these really big ideas and solutions?
So problems we face every day, and you just got to get used to it. For example, bureaucrats will stall action for a long, long time or even never do it. So wasting time with bureaucrats is a given. You have to decide at some point you want to give up or just put it on hold and go do something else, but never hold your breath waiting for somebody. If any one time you try 40, 50 ideas simultaneously cooking, something will succeed. So if you keep doing one thing, if that one thing didn't happen, then your entire year or your lifetime is wasted. So how do you have capacity to do 40 or 50 items simultaneously? Again, the answer is leverage. You work with many, many people. You plant the seeds with them. And only when the seeds is ripe to grow, they will call you back. And they'll say, remember you told me this 3 months ago. Or remember we met 10 years ago and you told me this. And then I'm ready now. And the stars have to be aligned, but the more seeds you sow, the more is going to come back. Especially if you engage the media. For example, now I'm talking to you and there are a lot of people listening in. maybe a couple of the people, not too many, will look me up and say, you know, I heard you on the podcast and I'm going to suggest an idea that we can work together. All the time, serendipity are waiting to happen. You have to open the door. You have to give permission. You have to invite people and they come. I'll give you an example. I went to Hong Kong to give a speech to property strategists and Microsoft was there and now they sit on our board for the BOP Hub and they are creating software and apps for the rural farmers and artisans in India with us. They also donate all the furniture in my new building. I've constructed this new SDG center in Singapore, 65,000 square feet. And we want to turn it to a de facto World Trade Center for the poor. And we think we can transform all poverty into business, just the way Singapore turned from third world to first world through business, and how China copied the Singapore model and got 700 million people out of poverty in the last 30 years. I believe poverty is not natural. It is man-made and we can solve it through the marketplace.
I just love how you approach the world. There's just like a whimsy, an optimism, a curiosity. And all of these are things, I guess, to some form, they come naturally. They're part of your personality. But in others, they're also something that you've curated and cultivated very intentionally. What are some of the biggest internal obstacles that you've had to overcome yourself in order to stay positive despite the ups and downs of, you know, being self-employed and having big opportunities sometimes fall through?
In the beginning, when I first got on television, I was very excited and I called all my friends to watch me on TV. And they all say, wow, Jack, you're on TV. I've got to go and watch. What time is it? What channel? And then next week, I'm on TV again and I call them. And this time they say, oh, you're on TV again. Let me see if I'm free. I'll watch it. And then I said to myself, something is wrong because why are you so excited to be on TV? And the answer is I was egoistic. I was feeling like a hero. And that's a problem. That's a trap that a lot of people faces. When your mission becomes you, you are screwed. You have to be the facilitator and the servant to the mission. You cannot be the hero. And when I go to America, I see the culture is you can be a hero. You have superpower. You. I think that's a very narrow focus. If you don't focus on you and you focus on the problem that you're trying to solve, you invite people to go to that beautiful journey by themselves or with you or with other friends without you, doesn't matter. You just tell them there is a much more beautiful future. Would you like to go there? And then they go. They go in their own name. If I say, would you like to come with me? I'm your leader. My name is Jack Sim. They'll say, get lost. Why should I follow you? And I think people don't want to follow somebody. They want to follow a mission. And if you create a movement, you are not important. The mission is important. And if you are able to understand that, you can generate a movement by being unimportant. This is the most important message, is to be unimportant.
It's awesome. It reminds me of one episode where we had a human trafficking survivor, Sophia Tiende, come in. And she was talking about how you are the most important person within a movement, but you're also the least important person in a movement. You're the most important person because you have to stand up. Your voice matters, but you're the least important person because even if you're not there, if you've done a good job, then your movement's going to continue. The movement's going to go on with or without you because that's what movements are about. They're about being bigger than yourself. And there's something really beautiful to that.
If you see all the movement, they seem to attribute it to somebody. But actually, the movement that somebody is symbolic because he can't be doing everything. And if you say the green movement, it started with Greenpeace. Nobody knows who is that Greenpeace leader. But it turns out that everybody now have this Paris Treaty, at least not America, but most other people join in, right? And then who is the leader? I mean, the one who takes the most money out of this is WWF, not Greenpeace. But it doesn't matter. Greenpeace created WWF. The most important thing is people joining the mission. And it's not your mission, my mission. It is the mission for a better humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. When I watched your documentary, one of the things that really stood out was how important it was for you to retain the sense of play and creativity and experimentation and failure. And we just did a podcast with a person who designed an empathy toy called Ilana Benari, and she was talking about how, you know, play is a way of learning. I'm curious to know how you cultivate a sense of play within such a serious environment. Like, so much of what you do, I mean, it's a life and death scenario, yet you seem to be able to retain a sense of lightheartedness and positivity. So where does that all come from?
If you don't grow up, you will still always be childlike. And to be able to retain your childlikeness is a very joyful way to live. The moment you become an adult, you become a deteriorated child. You become afraid. And when you have this fear, this inferiority complex, then you have cravings of recognition and having to please others. But the moment you stay as a child, you don't need all these things. Your authenticity, your sense of awe about society, nature, will keep you centered. Although I'm 63, I behave like a child. And a child is creative, is able to be forgiving to myself. So I can do stupid things, I can make mistakes, and I'll forgive myself the next moment and say, it's okay, it doesn't matter. And I think if you are able to forgive yourself, others can forgive you because you are then oblivious of what they think of you. It's not important anymore. So being oblivious of the opinion of others gives me lots of freedom. And then I can stay on my own center and not to be distracted by trying to impress other people.
I think there's something really beautiful to that. So much of the world that we live in today is about virtue signaling. It's like a byproduct almost of, you know, having social media and the need to speak up and the need to show off what you care about and show what you are doing at every single moment in time. I'm curious to see how the next generation comes up because they've kind of grown up with the need to signal all of these things. But what you're saying about the value of really keeping things simple and keeping a sense of play does deeply resonate with me. Have you found that by being a creative person that you've been able to inspire more ideas inside of other people? Have people kind of come to your level, or do they just kind of look at you and find you a little bit funny and and weird, or are you able to change the way people think and tackle problems?
If I speak to an audience of 100, probably there are 2 persons who will actually go out and do something. Maybe there won't be anybody who take action that day. And some might take action 2 years later. I have a former manager. I used to work as a salesman. It's my only job. And then after that, I started business. 34 years after I left the company, and he left too to start his own business, he called me up and said, "Do you remember me? I'm Victor." I say, "Yes, you're my boss." He says, "I want to donate money to the World Toilet Organization because now I made a lot of money and I've been watching you and I want to support your movement." And this is really, really interesting because somebody 34 years ago, without any contact, come back and they have donated about $1.5 million to build rural school toilets in China. And we call it Rainbow School Toilet Program. And now we are using this model to ask other people to copy it and to use it. We're digitizing all our program and sharing it as an open source to 214,000 rural schools in China. I've never imagined 214,000 schools, but that's the number they have. And I would never have imagined starting a Rainbow School Toilet program in China just because a friend from 34 years ago called me and started this with me. So I think that you just keep on telling the stories and people take away or they don't, it's really up to them.
So you can only control what you can control. And so that means putting out the positive, like almost living the world that you want to see and, you know, letting those who will be inspired come back. Do you spend any time worrying about numbers and metrics and trying to quantify your success or the success of the movement? Or is that something that you just kind of ignore because you're just focused on the greater mission?
So after 20 years, we didn't count the metrics because to count the metrics costs money. And so you got to employ a consultant or all these people to count. So we got a pro bono public relation company called PublicSys. And they came to say, we'll help you quantify your impact. And now we are in the process of counting. If World Toilet Organization did not exist, what would have happened? And now that it exists, what has happened? We have to attribute it to a lot of people, to a whole global movement. But we could just say that if they still call it a water agenda instead of a sanitation agenda, then sanitation would not improve. And that was what they did 20 years ago, calling sanitation a water agenda. And we decoupled it, and now this is an agenda by itself.
I really love how you know, for me, I think it's because I had a background as an engineer or something, like trying to figure out how to measure the impact of art is something that is so top of mind. But for you, it's kind of like a nice to have, and you've just been so focused on actually going there and following your gut and building the coalitions and building leverage and telling stories without ever, you know, paying too much attention on all of these numbers. And so I think there's something really admirable there that I really appreciate. I'd like to end on one thing, and that is, you know, you come on these shows, you do these podcasts, you're working on all these new initiatives. If there's one thing that you could tell people, one message that they could take home and do, what would that thing be?
The one message I want everybody to take home is that no matter how young you are today, you are going to die. And all your ancestors did. And so all you have is the remaining number of days that you have to spend usefully on this planet. And find your fulfillment not by buying expensive watches and diamond and sports car, but find your usefulness in making the world better. Find a problem to solve and bring along friends to solve it. Because the highest exchange of time is service. If you are able to, on the last day of your life, say to yourself, I have been useful, I think you will be fulfilled. What you want is relationship with yourself, to find peace with yourself when you go, to find peace with the relationship you have with your spouse, your family, your community, your nation, your planet. And it's all about relationship. On your last day, it will be very irrational to check your bank balance and say, oh, I have so many millions of dollars, and then close your eyes and go and die. You can bring those money along. You were all the time trying to be rich, not because you could bring the money along, but to make other people feel small. What's the point of making other people feel small just by feeling big? It's better to make other people big, and not big in the sense of show off, but in the sense of social justice. Go find people who you can help and go help them.
That's deep and so simple. If people want to follow you and keep up with your crazy adventures and big radical ideas, how should they do that?
Also, please share my email address so everybody can send me an email. I'm not on Twitter. It's too stressful to be on Twitter. I'm an old man, so please email me. I'm on Facebook. My Facebook is open, so you can find me. I post quite regularly on my Facebook, not just tell about the work, but also about personal philosophy, about the state of the world, the politics, the educational system. And I think there are a lot of things that are really wrong that needs to be changed. The world is actually badly designed because it was designed for a masculine world. we have to redesign the world to a feminine world. Not female, not feminist, not woman, but in feminine philosophy, that means we have to serve people just as a mother loves the family unconditionally and facilitate the success of the family. Every man and woman has to love their community, their country, their planet in the same way the mother loves the children, the husband, and herself. So we need to migrate from a masculine society to a feminine society following the philosophy of the mother.
Love it. Love it. Thank you so much for sharing all this wisdom. Appreciate you having you here.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Alrighty, guys, that was Jack Sim from the World Toilet Organization. And if you're curious to learn more about his latest initiative, you should go check it out at bophub.org. I also highly recommend that you guys follow Jack on Facebook. It's just Jack Sim, and he's always dropping a series of wisdom bombs and thought-provoking commentaries that I think everyone would really benefit from. And for those who want to reach out to him by email, it's jacksim@worldtoilet.org. For those of you who really enjoyed the podcast and would love to see a series of notes, head over to impacteverywhere.org, where I put up a summary along with a series of quotes and social assets and all this stuff that you can just collect and share out with the world, because sharing is caring. And finally, for next week, we have a social entrepreneur dialing in all the way from Australia by the name of Graham Ross, who is tackling the massive problem of textile waste. We throw away some 13 million tons of textile waste every single year, and less than 15% of that is actually recycled, and Graham is hoping to change that. I hope you guys are enjoying this series so far. If you are, make sure to leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It really means a lot. And remember to stay positive, because impact is everywhere.